Stanley Carnow describes his new book as the story of America's only major colonial experience, the story of why Americans colonized the Philippines, what they did there, and what has been the legacy of their rule. The downfall of Ferdinand Marcos and the election of Corazon Aquino have heightened American awareness of these islands on the Pacific Rim. Carnow wants to extend our understanding to the less familiar history that puts the recent drama in context. Stanley Carnow first covered the Philippines 30 years ago as the chief Asia correspondent for Time magazine. He later reported on Asia for the Saturday Evening Post, the London Observer, and NBC News. But perhaps his most memorable contribution to our understanding of that region is the public TV series which he wrote, Vietnam, A Television History, and his companion book, which was a bestseller. His new book is called In Our Image, America's Empire in the Philippines. I asked Stanley Carnow if the Philippines seemed like a logical subject to explore after Vietnam.
Well, I did think that it was logical, if you can use that word, to go from an area where the United States had been very deeply involved, that is Vietnam, to an area where the United States, in a way, had been even more deeply involved historically, which is the Philippines. That is, the Philippines had been an American colony from 1899, 1898 to 1946. We'd spent a lot more time there, obviously, than we did in Vietnam. And perhaps it seemed to me, I'm not sure that I actually sat down and charted this and planned it, but what I've been trying to do is to tell these stories about America abroad, not about necessarily the countries themselves. In other words, this is the book on my latest book, In Our Image, is really a book about America in a foreign climate, in a foreign country, and not a history of the Philippines. I mean, that's for the Filipinos to do. You know how often it is that you go abroad and discover yourself, and that's, in a sense, what the book is about.
Before we get into the story of the United States' involvement in the Philippines, let me ask you a question about your research on the Philippines. Did you start your research on this book before or after Corazon Aquino took over the Philippines?
I started the research on the book in late 1983, early 1984, before she took over as president. I started to think about the book and the television series that goes with it soon after her husband, Benigno Aquino, was assassinated, which was in August of 1983.
And he had been a friend of yours?
He'd been a friend of mine. I say that I kind of broke the rules for a journalist to befriend a politician. But he was a fascinating guy, and we did become friends. And it occurred to me after he was assassinated that this was going to be a major story. I had no idea how it was going to develop, and least of all the idea that his wife would become president of the Philippines.
There must have been some frustrating times for you when you were looking at what was happening in 1898, and in the meantime, all this new stuff was happening on the Philippines. You know, Marcos was leaving the island, and Cory was taking over. Do you know what I mean? It must have been hard for you to decide when to look at the present and when to look at the past.
Well, it's true. I was looking at the two things at the same time, but I really did feel that I was not going to write a book like many of the other books that have come out about this immediate period.
Mm-hmm.
The immediate period, let's say for the last 5 or 6 years, those years were of great interest to me. but I wanted to put them in a perspective that went back to the turn of the century. So I tried hard not to be deflected tried hard not to be diverted by the current events. It wasn't easy. I mean, Cory Aquino, for example, would say to me, well, aren't you coming out to the polls to do this? Or I'm giving a speech this afternoon. You ought to come in. And I had to say, well, I'll try and turn up for it if I can. But I really would much prefer to spend my time in the library doing some research, because I could always listen to her speech on the radio or see it on television. And I really, when I got down to doing the book, as you can see from the size of it, that I had to put this present period in the perspective of the past 90 years.
Well, let's talk about the history of America's involvement in the Philippines. First of all, you say that compared to Europe, the U.S. was benign and sentimental as imperialists. Did we handle the Philippines differently than, say, the Europeans handled their colonies?
I think in general we were less exploitive, and that was because it wasn't necessary for the United States to go abroad for markets or raw materials. All that, most of that was in the United States itself. I mean, the wealth of America was greater than anything we needed abroad. So we went abroad with a certain kind of missionary zeal, so to speak, and we were determined to turn the Filipinos into facsimile Americans. From the very beginning, we set up a judicial system. We held elections. One of the most important things we did was to bring in school teachers. As early as 1901, about 1,000 school teachers who fanned out around the islands opened schools under miserable conditions to teach the Filipinos English, so that English has become almost the common language of the Philippines. Now, if you compare that to other colonial experiences, the French really exploited places like Vietnam. Whole provinces were turned into rubber plantations or rice fields owned by French companies. The British did the same in India. The Dutch did the same in Indonesia. It's interesting that Congress, very early on in this century, passed a law forbidding Americans to own more than about 1,000 acres of land in the Philippines. I think this was, relative to the to European colonialism, I do think it was benign, progressive. Now, there's another way of looking at it, which is, in terms of our own aims, was it successful? And there I think we find that it falls down. We thought we were going to establish democracy in the Philippines, and we did bring in democratic institutions. But they became distorted and warped because they didn't fit Filipino values. Filipinos relate to each other very personally. The key to the society is the family, the ritual kin, the village, the town, and lastly, the nation, lastly, the entity. And, you know, we believe, or at least ideally, in impersonal institutions. Everybody is equal before the law. And so here are two societies that the American society colliding with the Philippine society, and I think two societies are totally dissimilar, totally different in their outlooks.
Why did the United States enter the Spanish-American War in 1898? What were our motives?
The United States at the end of in the closing decades of the 19th century was booming economically, and it was industrializing very quickly. We had waves of immigrants coming to the United States, adding to the labor force. It was a tremendously dynamic period in American history. And there was one faction in the United States, in Washington, the imperialist faction, composed of people like Theodore Roosevelt, Senator Lodge of Massachusetts, and others, who felt that we had to project this enormous industrial power abroad, that we had to go forth and become a world power. There was another faction consisting of people like Mark Twain and Andrew Carnegie, the steel tycoon, who said, no, that's not the thing to do. The thing to do is stay at home. We have no business going and projecting our power abroad. There was a very sharp debate over what to do. And suddenly, you had this rebellion in Cuba, the Cubans rebelling against Spanish rule. And the Cuban lobby in the United States, there was a Cuban propaganda machine in the United States, which was very, very effective. Supported by American interests, sugar interests that had plantations in Cuba, and through a series of accidents, and history is so often a series of accidents, we went to war with Cuba, with Spain over Cuba. The president of the United States at the time, William McKinley, was a conspicuously indecisive man who couldn't make up his mind, and he kind of got railroaded into the war. The Philippines was a Spanish possession, and Theodore Roosevelt, who was an assistant, young assistant secretary of the Navy, secretly ordered Commodore Dewey, who had a small squadron in Asia, to attack the Spanish fleet. And Dewey did. He sank the Spanish fleet in 7 hours on May 1st, 1898, soon after the Spanish surrendered. And then everyone said, well, what are we going to do with these islands? McKinley couldn't even locate them on the map. And so after much debate, McKinley decided to annex to keep the Philippines. And there we were. We got involved. And again, it's so typical history, in my estimation, that things that start out, events that start out accidentally, start out as expedients, start out as diversions, as this was, suddenly become dogmas, and we find ourselves stuck in this place, committed to this place, and so we have to begin to justify it. And the justification became one of, we will go in there and we will convert these people to our way of life. The first civilian governor, American civilian governor of the Philippines, William Howard Taft, referred to the Filipinos as our little brown brothers. It was a really condescending phrase, but deep down, I think he really thought that he was doing God's work out there.
So the mission was supposed to be modernize and Americanize. But you say that one of the big mistakes that United States made in the Philippines was that we coddled the elite and we ignored the problems of peasants.
The kind of people that represented the Filipino elite were the kind of people that our own officials are comfortable with. William Howard Taft, who was a Republican from Ohio, was comfortable with an upper-class Filipino. In that respect, many of these upper-class Filipinos were extraordinarily well-educated. And so American policy, colonial policy and practice for the first 10, 12 years was to work through this upper class. And in doing so, we were not going to ruffle an upper class which based its power and wealth in a feudal land system. And so there was very little reformism in American foreign policy or colonial policy. But I might add that there was very little reformism in American policy at home either until you get to the New Deal in the 1930s of the Franklin Roosevelt administration.
Let me ask you about what you were just saying. You said that we coddled the elite, we ignored the problems of peasants. American officials felt more comfortable with the Philippine elite. Did this pave the way, do you think, for the abuses of Marcos? I mean, was the American attitude in part responsible for the corruption that ended up in the highest offices in the Philippines?
Well, it's a big jump from our policy in, let's say, 1910 or 1920 to the Marcos period. But let me put it this way, that at the end of the American colonial period in 1946, there was an entrenched oligarchy, an entrenched group of families, and there is to this day. Now, Marcos came along, and in a sense, you could argue that Marcos really tried to destroy the old oligarchy. The problem with Marcos was, once having destroyed it, he replaced it with his own cronies, so that his own cronies, in turn, out to be worse than the old entrenched oligarchy. Part of it was that they were hungrier for money and lusted after wealth and were much more corrupt than anything we'd seen before. Marcos is overthrown. Mrs. Aquino comes in, calling her takeover of power a revolution. In fact, it's a restoration because the old families are back again. Now, to blame it on the United States is, in my estimation, partly true. We didn't do anything to destroy those old landed families going back to the turn of the century. But also, the Filipinos themselves didn't do anything to undermine those old families. So that you can't pin it all on the United States. I think it's always a kind of what I would call a sort of liberal racism to blame the United States for all the problems of other countries. I mean, the Filipinos are people. If one respects them as individuals, then one has to believe that they themselves ought to be doing things. They themselves ought to be reforming their society. We can't go around blaming the United States for everything that's wrong in these countries.
As you point out in the book, after World War II, many nationalistic movements were initiated, movements trying to throw off colonial rule. But only in the Philippines did that transition occur peacefully. This was ironically applauded by Ho Chi Minh, who later ended up not applauding America's actions. Why did this occur peacefully? Why did the United States give independence to the Philippines right after World War II, 1946?
Mind you, I want to point out that consistent with what I call relative benevolence, Congress in 1916 had voted the Jones Act, named for a Virginia congressman, to give eventual independence to the Philippines. And this is quite extraordinary for a colonial power. I mean, the French, the British, the Dutch, and the others never even contemplated the idea of giving independence to their colonies. So there was in this American, in this mix, an American desire really to lead, guide the Philippines, tutor the Philippines toward self-government. So in 1946, it was logical finally to declare or to give the Philippines their independence.
So the United States gave independence to the Philippines in 1946, but you point out that ironically, Americans had greater privileges after we gave independence to the Philippines.
Yes, we compelled the Philippines to amend their constitution, their 1935 constitution, to permit Americans to have equal rights in the exploitation of natural resources. And all that was were the strings that were attached to our giving aid for the rehabilitation of the Philippines after the Second World War. I mean, every country acts in self-interest, and that was in America's self-interest at that stage, or at least in the interests of the groups that were lobbying for those rights, the American groups.
Although most of your book focuses on the history of the Philippines, and as you pointed out earlier, while all this upheaval was happening in the Philippines, you were frequently in the library. I know that you nevertheless did a lot of research into what happened in the last few years in the Philippines. Do you feel like you dug up anything that was new, that was unknown before, about the way the United States government handled Marcos and Aquino during Marcos's final days and Aquino's transition into power?
Well, I think I have the only account in the book of the really the final moments and the moments that preceded that, in which the group in the State Department, plus some people in the Pentagon, notably the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral William Crow, really exerted pressure on President Reagan to discard Marcos, whom Reagan had considered to be an old friend. And I have almost, and I think this is unique, if I could sound immodest about it, almost the minute-by-minute play of that final day on February 23rd, 1986, the meetings that took place at Secretary of State Shultz's house in Bethesda, the meeting that took place in the White House afterward. I was very fortunate to be able to get notes of those meetings, almost a transcript of those meetings, and recreate exactly what happened.
What do you think Aquino's chances are now of fixing the economy, of getting more equity in the country, of undoing some of the damage that's been done?
Cory Aquino inherited not only 20 years of Marcos and all the corruption and plunder, to which to this day we can't even estimate, but she also inherited centuries of social disparities between rich and poor, rigidities. She inherited, although the Catholic Church in the Philippines is very liberal in many respects, it is very rigid on the issue of family planning and birth control, and that's one of the key problems in the Philippines. Imagine, in my own lifetime, when I went to the Philippines in the 50s, the population was something like 20 million. Today it's 60 million. I mean, before one's very eyes, you can see the population tripling. So I think that Cory Aquino is going to survive to the end of her term. She may even run for another term. I don't know. But I don't think she's going to be able to grapple with all these fundamental problems. Why? First of all, the problems themselves are enormous. And they do require, in my estimation, and I don't want to sound preachy about this, but they really require drastic renovation, almost a revolution. And she is a quite a conservative person. She comes from a rich landowning family, and she doesn't see herself as a revolutionary. She is dedicated to the what she calls democracy and stability, and building up the rebuilding the economy. But I don't see that she's going to be able to impose a completely new deal in the Philippines.
You describe your new book as history written by a journalist. Do you think that journalists write history from a different perspective than historians do? And I'm wondering even if when you studied history, when you were either in college or in high school, if there were things that didn't come to life that you've tried to bring to life as a journalist?
Journalists are historians. In a way, when you're working for a daily newspaper and you sit down at the end of the day to file your story about what happened during that day, you are, in a sense, a historian. If you work for a weekly, it's the same. The deadline's different. Macaulay, the British historian, once said that journalism is history under pressure, written under pressure. What I try to do, and I've now, in this book and in earlier books, is to try to write history as if it were contemporary, as if it were happening, as if I was a reporter in 1898 reporting on Dewey sinking the Spanish fleet.
Once again, you've described the Philippines as the United States' only major colonial experience. Now, we've had relationships with other foreign countries where we have exploited the country for our own benefit. But do you think our experience in the Philippines explains why that was our only major colonial experience?
The actual acquisition of territory began in 1899 when we went to war to conquer the country from a Filipino nationalist movement that had declared independence. And it was a very bloody war. It lasted for 2.5 years. Something like 200,000 Filipinos were killed, most of them civilians. I think that when that was over, the atrocities of that war that were reported in the American press turned off Americans on territorial conquest. True, we have since tried to dominate countries politically or economically, overthrow their governments, manipulate their leaders, all the things that superpowers do in smaller countries. But the public taste for the actual acquisition of territory, I think, was very much turned off. There is an anti-colonial tradition in the United States, having been a colony ourselves. I don't think people were entirely comfortable with it during that conquest. And they weren't entirely comfortable with having a colony. It's interesting that the American officials in the Philippines, from the very start, the turn of the century, never referred to themselves as colonial officials. We never had a colonial office. We had a euphemism for it. We called it the Bureau of Insular Affairs, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
If you told an American that he was a colonial official in those days, he would have reacted against that. The idea of being a colonial in the British or French sense never entered the heads of Americans. They thought they were there to do good. They were almost there as secular missionaries, in a sense.
One last question. We only have about a minute remaining. In your previous series, Vietnam, a television history that was shown on public television, you used incredible footage from newscasts and, you know, other footage that journalists had gathered in Vietnam. What kind of comparable footage have you been able to find about the Philippines? And I'm talking about the earlier history before there was television. I mean, have you been able to locate gripping visual representation for the series?
Well, obviously, we couldn't have gotten film that didn't exist before the invention of the movie camera. We do have, it's interesting that with research, we found really interesting film from the early period of the century. In one case, we used movie footage that was made by Thomas Edison in New Jersey, recreating battle scenes in the Philippines. Obviously, we say it's a recreation. Then people came to us with home movies from the 1920s, 1930s, diaries of grandparents and parents who'd been school teachers or army officers, and, of course, the recollections of people. So the Philippines, it was not entirely in the television age as Vietnam was, but I think the stuff that we have on our television series on the Philippines is quite remarkable.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your research into the Philippines. Thank you.